As you're aware, this is the first of a series of talks that we're going to give. These are not actually sermons as such, because we're not just expounding Bible passages, but we're going to be looking at topical issues. So tonight I will be referring to the Bible a number of times, but I will mainly be talking about science and faith in general. Let's just start by having a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this day, and we thank you for the opportunity to be able to come together to look at science and faith, about their relationship to one another, about whether they really are opponents or whether they are in fact friends that work together. We pray, O Lord, that you might help us to think about this, that you might guide me as I bring these things to us tonight, and that if there are any questions, that we might be able to try and answer those after the talk is finished. These things we pray now in Jesus' name. Amen. The story goes something like this. Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson go on a camping trip, and at the end of the evening they retire to their tent to go to sleep. About 3 o'clock in the morning, Holmes nudges Watson and says, "Watson, look up into the sky and tell me what you see." Watson says, "I see millions of stars." "And what does that tell you?" Watson replies, "Well, astronomically, it tells me there are millions of galaxies and potentially billions of planets. Theologically, it tells me that God is great and that we are small and insignificant. Horologically, it tells me it's about 3 a.m. Meteorologically, it tells me that we will have a beautiful day in the morning. What does it tell you, Holmes?" "Well, elementary, dear Watson. Someone's stolen our tent." As you can see, logic and intellect don't always give us the answers that we're looking for. Such is the case with science. You see, science is about answering questions. It involves gathering information and making conclusions. But over the last 150 years, and particularly in the last generation, science has changed and has taken on a whole new role, a whole new identity. And the thing that has suffered the most during this time of change is faith. Firstly, let's consider the question, what is science? Science is about gathering information and making sense of it. It is a quest for knowledge. It looks for patterns in our world and seeks to explain the how questions of life, the how questions of the world. But it can never answer the why questions. It relies heavily on observation and experimentation. Repeatability and predictability are key aspects of this quest. And this is where the scientific method, using empirical measurements gained by the five senses, has been instrumental in the advancement of scientific knowledge. However, information gathered by this method must be interpreted. All information must be interpreted. As scientist and theologian Alistair McGrath says, the process of observation, whether scientific or religious, involves trying to match what is observed with what is believed, and then making any necessary adjustments. As Christians, we see science as a study that comes out of the order that God has put in creation. As we read in Psalm 8 tonight, God is the one who made all things. He is the one who set them in place. And it's a beautiful and awesome sight to see. We see with wonder the creation that God has made. It's an indication of God's beauty, of his wonder, of his power, of his strength, of his majesty. And he has chosen man to rule over that creation. Creation is ours to use. It is ours to rule over, yet it actually doesn't belong to us. But we are given power and authority over it. And this includes searching for patterns, trying to find things, to explain things, to be able to understand creation so that we are better equipped to use it and look after it. Hence, the pursuit of scientific knowledge is a natural outworking of part of our purpose, that is, to be wise stewards of God's creation. For us to be able to understand science properly, we need to look at its history. Mankind's always sought to comprehend the world around us, and it's therefore impossible to say when science truly began. We do know that the ancient Babylonians studied the stars and were able to make accurate predictions because of this. We know that physics goes back way past the time of Aristotle, and that modern medicine owes much to Hippocrates, who lived nearly 2,500 years ago. Even through the so-called Dark Ages, scientific advancements were made and new knowledge was developed. Near and far Eastern science developed at an even quicker rate than Western science. The Chinese developed gunpowder. The Arab alchemists refined techniques that are used in modern-day chemistry. And Alhazen devised the foundations of the scientific method that we know today. But it wasn't until the time of the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, that modern science really took off. Beginning in the 1600s, enormous changes took place. The Reformation was changing the face of religion in Europe. The printing press was opening up information to the masses, and the foundations were being laid for the Industrial Revolution. People like Galileo, William Harvey, John Ray, Francis Bacon, Nicholas Copernicus, Isaac Newton, Edmund Halley, and John Dalton changed the way that we thought about the world. And many, if not most of them, were men of strong faith. Faith and science were closely bound. Nearly everyone believed in a god of some sort. This was the filter through which science developed. Chemistry, biology, physics, anatomy, astronomy, all of these were sciences, but the queen of the sciences was theology, the study of God. It seemed that faith and science were inextricably linked, and things stayed that way until the mid-18th century. Now, you will have heard of Charles Darwin, I'm sure, but you may not have heard of Immanuel Kant or Thomas Huxley. But they were key players in the change that took place. Immanuel Kant was a brilliant German philosopher and theorist. In the mid-1700s, he was putting forward theories about how the solar system and the galaxies formed. He was a dedicated atheist who sought to explain things rationally, but also empirically and naturalistically, that is, just by using the five senses. His goal was to explain things in terms of the purely natural, that is, to do away with considering anything that was supernatural. By the use of circular arguments, he sought to convince others that if there was a God, that there was no way that we could truly know about him or understand him. And due to the eloquence of his arguments and the force of his character, a growing number of people became persuaded to accept Kant's viewpoint. With the seeds of doubt sown and left to grow, we move forward 100 years to the mid-1800s. Science was still the pursuit of amateurs, the wealthy, and the thinkers of society at that time, including theologians. But in 1859, a shy British botanist by the name of Charles Darwin proposed his theory of evolution. It described mutations and natural selection as the mechanics of change in species. It gained some attention, but would not have taken hold if it had not been for the efforts of Thomas Huxley. Now, Huxley was a bright man, also had incredible sideburns if you saw the picture before there. He was also an aggressive man. He was a biologist and a devout atheist. And when he heard of Darwin's theory, even though he didn't really agree with it all, he saw it as a vehicle that he could use to push an atheist agenda. You see, Huxley wanted to push any thoughts of God out of the scientific realm. And so what he did was he began setting up public debates between evolution and creationism. He cleverly used the media and drew public attention to these debates. Huxley repeatedly described the debates as science versus religion. See, he set them up as if they were opposites. That was just something that he did to manipulate this. And so he used this antagonism between science and religion that he was setting up, as well as his I suppose, great wit to humiliate and denigrate opponents and their viewpoints. Huxley believed that with constant pressure, you could persuade people to accept your viewpoint. But he didn't take anything to chance. His quick-witted comments and stinging put-downs were ripe pickings for the press, and so Huxley took on the self-appointed key role of being the ambassador for Darwinism, or for evolution. He was known as Darwin's bulldog, and not only forced his view, but set up a counterfeit view of religion, a paper tiger that he could tear to pieces and tear down so that people would lose faith in faith. He then set his sights on the heart of scientific power, the key organisation that oversaw the collection and distribution of scientific knowledge, the Royal Society. Huxley gathered around him other strong-willed atheists to join the society. He knew that if he and his colleagues, who called themselves the X Club, could control the society, then they could change the face of science. And this is what they did. By 1873, they had taken over the society, and for the next 13 years, every president of the Royal Society was a devout atheist and member of the X Club. Sounds like something from Marvel Comics, doesn't it, the X Club? They also sought to change the amateurish view of science and change it to become more professional, to get people who were just scientists rather than people who were involved in other fields. This meant that they could exclude part-timers or people from these other fields from having the same influence in science that they had had before. And this especially applied to theologians. And so the plan was hatched and it was carried out to perfection. Science was now seen as something that was removed from faith. It was based upon so-called facts and did not have the apparent bias of a position of faith. But what had really happened was a philosophical change. A naturalistic or atheistic worldview had snuck in and disguised itself, claiming to be the only truth. This has been the view that's been propagated forcefully and is now widespread throughout Western society. This false war between science and faith has been simply stated by Australian atheist comic Tim Minchin, where he says, "Science adjusts its view based upon what's observed. Faith is the denial of observation so that belief can be preserved." This is the type of lie that gets the coverage in our popular media. Kirsten Burkett, an academic who researches the history and philosophy of science, explains this present situation particularly well. She says that ignorance of what the Bible actually says about God's work in the world and misunderstanding of the reasonable limitations of scientific explanation created a public conflict which is to a large degree misguided. Science has been staggeringly successful in helping us to understand the world. There is no doubt about that. But rarely do we hear of the limitations of science. Alistair McGrath said, "Science is far from the only source of truth. It has purchased its great success by its modest ambition," or by the modesty of its ambition. Notice that there. Science has purchased its great success by the modesty of its ambition. But things are changing now. You see, science can only explain things in the physical world. It can only explain things by using natural and physical means. And so, within these bounds, it does a great job. By using experimentation and repetition, it's been able to explain and predict a myriad of things that have been beneficial for society. But at the same time, it has limitations. For example, science cannot understand love. It can describe electronic impulses and neural pathways. It can describe chemical reactions that release endorphins and pheromones that give sensations associated with love. But it cannot explain love. It cannot explain what gives us personhood, what makes us individuals. Nor can it explain anything that's intangible. It cannot explain anything that goes beyond the physical. In many ways, it is limited in time and space to the here and now. But this does not stop science from going beyond its boundaries or from scientists claiming expertise and wisdom beyond their fields based upon the kudos they receive from simply being scientists. Cosmology, origins, and the real nature of matter are all areas of scientific research that go beyond the limits of science. And yet, so-called scientific theories and ideas in these areas are claimed as being fact when they are largely conjecture based upon a philosophical viewpoint. It is then that science becomes a belief system, a religion. This is the point that we encounter in popular science today, the pagan, atheistic, naturalistic religion popularised and forcefully espoused by its own high priests, such as Richard Dawkins. What we find here is the same thing that was happening in Genesis chapter 11, our second reading, the Tower of Babel. Here we see mankind deciding that they would band together to be like God. This was the purpose of the tower they built. They were trying to reach up to God and to be like him. They wanted to put themselves on a par with him, to make a name for themselves. In other words, they were worshipping themselves and their own achievements. They were trying to do away with God and take his place. This is why God had to judge them. This is why he confused their language. This is why he scattered them. He was showing them that he is God, the one and only true God. Today we find a number of people who worship their own intellect. They refuse to believe in a God and make use of the naturalistic explanations of science to support their view. They are the new atheist movement. They are aggressive and they are intolerant of opposing views as they propose their own views as being superior simply because they have them. At the same time, they label people of faith, especially Christian faith, as being simplistic, old-fashioned, inferior, and stupid. They see that it's not possible to have a faith and also to be intelligent. They see science as the enemy of faith. But as we have seen, this is not really the case. So is it possible to be a Christian and to be a scientist? Or does becoming a scientist mean that you have to throw away your faith? The obvious answer is that you can be a Christian and a scientist at the same time. Many scientists throughout the ages have been strong Christians. Consider some of the great scientists of the past. Here we go, I'll try and say a few. Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler, Descartes, Pascal, Boyle, Newton, Bernoulli, Galvani, Ampère, Dalton, Ohm, Maxwell, Hertz, Pasteur, Stokes, Kelvin, Becquerel, Rayleigh, Walcott, Marconi, Thomson, Bragg, Planck, Millikan, Fleming, Leonard, Heisenberg and von Braun, just to name a few as I ran out of breath. But what about today? Are there any scientists who still believe? Any real scientists? Well, let me just name a few for you. The first one I have here is Francis Collins. He's the current director of the National Institutes of Health in the United States. He's also the one who was the director of the Human Genome Project, probably the greatest scientific research that was done in the second half of the 20th century through to the start of the 21st century, where they actually mapped all of the genes that are on every human chromosome. They can tell you where they are, but they don't know what they all do. Excuse me. That was what the project was. He was the one who was in charge of this worldwide research, the very top person. And yet, he is a devout Christian, and he is someone who has written numerous things about faith and science. The second person I'll mention here is Brian Kobilka. He won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry in 2012 and is the professor of the departments of molecular and cellular physiology at Stanford University School of Medicine. Yeah, not bad qualifications there. Gerhard Ertel won the 2007 Nobel Prize for Chemistry. He has said in an interview that, "I believe in God. I am a Christian and I try to live as a Christian. I read the Bible very often and I try to understand it." Anthony Hewish is a British radio astronomer who won the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1974. He said, this is a really interesting one, you have to think about this, when he was looking at things in nature, he found that some things were almost counterintuitive. So listen to his explanation, or what he sees as the meaning behind this. "Religious belief in God and Christian belief may seem strange to common sense thinking, but when the most elementary physical things behave in a non-intuitive way, we should be prepared to accept that the deepest aspects of our existence go beyond our common sense understanding." In other words, we don't know everything. The last person that I'll mention is someone who's coming to Australia in a few months' time, John Lennox. John Lennox is a lovely man from Northern Ireland. If ever you hear him, he's got this lovely lilting accent. He's like a lovely Irish grandfather, and you just listen with, "Oh, isn't he lovely?" He's professor of mathematics at Oxford University. He has 3 earned doctorates in different fields. Now, that means that he hasn't been given them as an honorary thing. He's actually earned them, including mathematics and science. And he's a regular speaker at conferences, both mathematical and Christian. He is someone who is a Christian apologist who will stand up for a Christian faith. He's written a number of books, including God's Undertaker, Has Science Buried God, which... probably about the first 2/3 of it is really good reading, really easy to read. The last third of it's quite technical. But it's a great book for you to read at some point if you'd like to have some more information on this. He's also debated many atheistic opponents, including Richard Dawkins, and certainly has come out on top on just about every occasion there. And there are many, many more Nobel Prize winners and professors and people who are professional scientists who are devout Christians. So, we've seen that science and faith are not actually opposites. They're not really enemies. It's not a matter of one being true and the other false. Both seek truth, but both seek to answer different questions. Science seeks to tell us how things work. Faith seeks to tell us why. Rather than enemies working in competition, they actually work together. No matter what faith you have, for even atheism is a faith, it is your faith that enables you to interpret the information that science gathers. C.S. Lewis once explained this relationship well when he said, "I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else." Our faith illuminates the things that we see around us. Our faith helps us to make sense of the world around us. The Bible clearly shows us that Christians are not to stop using their intellect. In Romans 12, verse 2, we read that our minds play an important role in our faith. "Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind." All people base their understanding of science and the physical world upon underlying assumptions or beliefs. But people who refuse to acknowledge God can never see the true meaning or purpose in the world. They can explain it, but they can't see that purpose. Proverbs 3:7 tells us, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is understanding." True wisdom, not just knowledge, begins with God. Without Him, our knowledge and wisdom are incomplete. Without Him, science becomes our master rather than a tool that we use to understand the world. So are science and faith enemies? The answer is a clear and dogmatic no. Well, we're now going to have the opportunity to ask some questions. I've asked Peter Bull to come up as well to see if there are any questions that he or I might be able to answer. I certainly haven't sought to try and cover everything about science and faith, but I've tried to give you a bit of an idea about how science and faith do work together. So do you have any questions at the moment? Does anyone have a question for us?
Just an easy question. No, it's not really. What's a Christian perspective on Darwin's theory of evolution?
Okay. That's a really good question. There, do you want to have a go first or me too, Pete?
I'd like to listen to your answer first.
Is that called passing the buck? No. There are a number of different ways that we can look at origins. We can look at origins and say that we believe in a literal view of the Bible, of Genesis chapter 1, where we say that each of the days of creation is in fact a 24-hour day. There are some people who believe that. There are some people who believe that you only count the actual years that are mentioned in the Bible, so we have a young earth model, and that God created things mature as they are. That's one viewpoint, which is basically completely rejecting evolution. There's the atheistic view of evolution, which is at the other extreme, and there are all sorts of views in the middle. There are some people who believe that believe in what's called microevolution. Microevolution means that we see changes in species, but it's changes from, like, two dogs breed and you get another breed of dog, okay? It's not like you have an elephant and a mouse breed and you get a cow. It's the type of thing where you can get new species that way through crossbreeding. We have within evolution, atheistic evolution, they've tried to bring in naturalistic ideas where they say, for example, the mutation is a key thing that occurs for changes to happen. It's something where, do you believe that occurs by itself? Do you believe that God is the one that uses a mechanism, be it evolution or some other mechanism? The answer is really, we don't know. Evolution is a theory. It is a model that tries to fit with information we've got. But whether you believe it is the particular thing that is right or not comes back to your underlying beliefs, your underlying faith. I am not going to speak against it as a particular mechanism, but as a Christian, I believe that God created things with a purpose. I believe that as we read Genesis chapter 1, it's very clear that we see that God created things with a purpose. But whether they were 24-hour days or not, that is something that I don't think we have to know. I don't think we have to believe they are 24-hour days. And I don't think we have to believe in a young earth model. Once again, I'm not saying yes or no. So I don't know if that's answered much, but it's just giving you the idea that there's a spectrum of different views. Pete?
Yeah, I think that's a classic example of, like, Darwinism versus the Bible. So this idea that there are enemies with the one viewpoint and another viewpoint, and that's probably the most obvious one that people come up against. And the extreme ends of the debate fight each other aggressively, and you see the action. But there's lots of people in the middle who are sort of a bit quieter and don't get so excited by all that. One thing that helped me from when I was a lot younger was someone said to me, well, it's God's world, so we won't ever be surprised by something we discover. So we won't be surprised We can be confident to look throughout the world, through the universe, to find something. And if we find our theory, maybe it's Darwin's theory, we can be confident that it won't contradict God because it's God's world. And if we find dinosaurs, well, it's not going to be a big shock to us because it's God's world. Maybe he made dinosaurs, that's fine. Or aliens. It's like, you come across these, like, people sort of have a go at you because you're a Christian. Oh, but what about dinosaurs? What about the aliens? What about how big the world, you know, the universe is? And they sort of throw these things at you. But if we trust that the Bible is saying it is God's world, it's God's universe, then we won't ever be surprised, or we can enjoy knowledge as it comes to us and assess it rightly.
Okay. Any other questions that people might have? One thing I will bring up, have you heard of the God of the Gaps theory? This is one I'd like to bring up. Some people believe that science can explain everything except there are certain things that it can't explain. Where you've got those gaps that science can't explain, that's where faith comes in. That's God. So God's in there. The problem with that, it's not biblical at all. And the problem with that is that as science grows in knowledge, the gaps get smaller and smaller. So your view of God gets smaller and smaller. If anyone talks about God just being the thing that fills the gaps, they completely misunderstand what we see our God as being like. As we were looking at Psalm 8, you could see that God is the one who made everything. God is sovereign over all. He is the one who is all-powerful. He is majestic. He's not the God of the gaps. He is the God of all creation. And so just be careful that you don't have people argue with a view of God that is a false view. Remember I spoke about paper tigers before? This is the type of thing where often people in arguments will set up a false view of something so they can tear that down and say, there, see you go, you're wrong, even though they're not really talking about what you believe in the first place. So that's one I didn't really have time to fit in there. Richard?
You mentioned John Lennox's book. Are there any other resources on this topic, on the internet or books that you could recommend?
Pete, do you want to start?
I just thought of one that I found very helpful was by Philip E. Johnson, so he's American, he's got a middle initial, Philip E. Johnson, and I've forgotten the name of his work, but he's got, he's a lawyer who looks at arguments, and he looks at the argument that creationists use, and he looks at the arguments that atheists use, and he sort of tries to assess those arguments and then present his view, and I found that very helpful.
There's a whole stack of books around. To be honest, one I didn't bring tonight I think is really good. Lee Strobel's got some fantastic books around. He's got four of them that start with the name The Case For. So The Case for a Creator is brilliant. Really good one if you want to have a look at some arguments about science. I've just brought a few along here. Anyone who is interested in where I got the name Unnatural Enemies from, Kirsten Burkett. I quoted from her. You cannot buy the book, but you can get the PDF of it, so it's cheaper than the book. You can actually get that from Matthias Media. John Lennox's book, God's Undertaker, really good. That one was $10 when I got it a few years ago. Another one that he put out, which is another really good one, Gunning for God, Why the New Atheists Are Missing the Target. That's a really good one. Once again, a similar sort of price. Hugh Ross is an American astrophysicist who's put out a number of books including The Fingerprint of God. Why the Universe is the Way It Is, that's one that's come out in recent times. He actually, when I was reading The Fingerprint of God, he looked at 23 different constants that we have. Things like the distance we are from the sun, the size of the moon compared to the size of the sun, all sorts of things like this. And there were 23 constants that are so finely tuned that basically any of them, if they're out by the smallest fraction of a percent, you wouldn't have life. And so basically, if you go through the statistics, life cannot exist, so you can't even hear what I'm saying. He also, in this book, he put an appendix on the internet. And he goes through all of these, lists all these arguments, and there's something like, I don't know, about 800 arguments that support creation. It's an incredible thing that he's got there. And here's another one. I mentioned Alistair McGrath. Alistair McGrath was someone who was a chemist and a physicist, particularly in quantum physics. And he then went from there to the logical step of becoming an Anglican priest, which is the next thing that you do. And this is a book, of course, that he put out. He's a brilliant man, by the way, absolutely brilliant. He's a professor, and he wrote this book called Surprised by Meaning, which I got a copy of just the other day. That's about $20, unless you get it on the Coorong sale. They were 20% off, which I did. I did have a couple of other books that I'd ordered to try and bring along to show you today, but unfortunately the mail didn't get here in time. But I hope that this has given you some indication of some things that are worth pursuing and things that it's worth looking at to realise that science and faith are not enemies, that in fact your Christian faith is something that can in fact be enhanced by an understanding of at least some of science. So I hope you've appreciated the talk tonight. Thank you very much.